ASDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
She joined the embassy shortly after October 7th, after she felt a high rise of anti-Semitism around her.
More on the victims of the shooting last night at the Jewish Museum.
Today is Thursday, May 22nd, and this is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. Coming up, California can set its own air pollution rules that are stricter than national standards.
Senate Republicans just took an extraordinary step to revoke that right.
I think they're somewhat frantic at the prospect of losing this Green New Deal policy.
Also, national parks will be understaffed this summer. What should you know before you visit?
Remember to be nice. The staff that you do see are going to be working their tails off. Tell them thanks for being there.
Plus, the Supreme Court deadlocks on religious charter schools.
First, this news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Jack Spear. An independent federal watchdog agency ruled today the Trump administration has violated the law by improperly freezing funds for an electric vehicle program. As NPR's Chris Arnold reports, at issue is the Empowerment Control Act that stops a president from withholding funds already approved by Congress.
The Government Accountability Office has at least 39 investigations into possible violations of the act by the Trump administration. This one involves $5 billion already allocated to build electric vehicle charging stations across the country. The GAO finds that the administration has been improperly freezing the money and must continue to carry out the program. The GAO also has the power to file a lawsuit. There are already other lawsuits underway over the allegedly illegal freezing of such funds. The White House has argued that the Impoundment Control Act is unconstitutional, but GAO points out that the Constitution specifically gives Congress the power of the purse. Chris Arnold, NPR News.
A Chicago man is facing federal charges for the killing of two Israeli embassy staffers in Washington. Federal prosecutors announced today charges less than 24 hours after Yaron Lachinsky and Sarah Milgram were gunned down outside a Jewish museum. NPR's Ryan Lucas has more.
Elias Rodriguez faces several charges, including first-degree murder, murder of a foreign official, as well as several gun charges. The interim U.S. attorney for Washington, D.C., Jeanine Pirro, called the shooting horrific and said her office will not tolerate such crimes.
We're going to continue to investigate this as a hate crime and a crime of terrorism, and we will add additional charges as the evidence warrants.
Officials say they believe Rodriguez acted on his own. According to court documents, he arrived in Washington, D.C. from Chicago on Tuesday, the day before the shooting. He allegedly told police after his arrest that he did it for Palestine and for Gaza. Ryan Lucas, NPR News, Washington.
The Trump administration is restoring in-person training at the National Fire Academy in Maryland after abruptly pausing it in March. As NPR's Frank Langfitt reports from Washington, the reversal today came after the Trump-supporting firefighters publicly criticized the move.
The administration initially paused in-person classes, saying they weren't mission critical. But now, it says, a comprehensive review found certain courses were, quote, effective. John Beck runs the Waynesboro Volunteer Fire Department in Pennsylvania.
We're getting back on track with the training that should have never been taken offline. But this is good news because this is exactly what the public deserves.
Each year, the Academy trains thousands of fire chiefs on everything from leadership to how to conduct fire and arson investigations. A source familiar with the process said the administration's handling of the Academy fits a broader haphazard approach to cuts and funding freezes. Frank Langford, NPR News, Washington.
You're listening to NPR. The Trump administration has revoked Harvard University's ability to enroll international students under the authority of the U.S. Department of Homeland Security. Details were sent in a letter to the school, and the changes impact currently enrolled international students. Homeland Security Secretary Kristi Noem in the letter accused the university of fostering anti-Semitism and collaborating with China's Communist Party. Harvard, for its part, issued a statement calling the action illegal. Harvard has nearly 7,000 international students, making up about 27% of the student body. The company behind the artificial intelligence chatbot, ChatGPT, is joining forces with one of the best-known designers in Silicon Valley to make AI-enabled devices. Here's NPR's John Ruwich.
OpenAI says it's buying a startup called I.O. for about $6.5 billion. I.O. was launched last year by the designer Johnny Ive, who created the iPhone and other iconic products for Apple. The tie-up deal links the legendary designer with Sam Altman, OpenAI's CEO and one of the driving forces behind the explosive growth of AI in recent years. The goal, they say, is to create AI-powered devices. OpenAI declined to say what exactly those devices would be. Companies are scrambling to create devices like glasses or robots that can sense the real world and analyze and interact with it using artificial intelligence. Altman previously invested in a company that attempted to make AI-enabled lapel pins about the size of an Apple Watch. John Ruwich, NPR News.
Stocks ended the session on a mixed note. The Dow was down 1 point to 41,859. The NASDAQ closed up 53 points. The S&P 500 was down 2 points today. I'm Jack Spear, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Walton Family Foundation, working to create access to opportunity for people and communities by tackling tough social and environmental problems. More information is at waltonfamilyfoundation.org.
On a Thursday, it's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. This afternoon, a suspect was charged in the killing of two people outside a Jewish museum here in Washington. He faces several counts, including two of first-degree murder, murder of a foreign official, and gun charges. President Trump has called the attack an act of anti-Semitism. NPR's Odette Youssef and Jennifer Ludden are covering the story and here with the latest. Hi there.
Hi.
Hi.
Jennifer, to begin with, what do police say happened?
Well, there was an event for young diplomats at the Capitol Jewish Museum downtown. It was hosted by the American Jewish Committee. And police say the suspect had been pacing outside the museum. And then after the event, around 9 o'clock last night, he targeted a group of four people and shot dead two of them. They say he then ran into the museum and was detained.
Israel's ambassador to the U.S. has said that the two people killed both worked at the embassy here. He said they were a young couple about to be engaged. What more can you tell us about them?
Yes. Yaron Lyshinsky was 30. He was a research assistant at the embassy. Sarah Lynn Milgram was 26, and she organized trips to Israel. The ambassador said Lyshinsky had bought a ring and planned to propose next week on a trip to Jerusalem. Now, Lyshinsky's family had spent time in Germany. He had both German and Israeli citizenship. Friends say he was actually a devout Christian. In a social media post in 2021, he wrote that Israel is the only place in the Middle East where Christians can thrive. I spoke with a friend of Sarah Milgram's, someone who knew her through the embassy here in D.C. Israeli attorney Ayelet Rezin Bet-Or has been researching sexual violence during the Hamas attack on Israel. That was on October 7th, 2023. And Milgram coordinated her U.S. presentations. She says Milgram was charming, she was always smiling, she'd light up a room, and that she saw a serious role for herself when she chose a job in diplomacy.
Sarah told me that she joined the embassy shortly after October 7th, after she felt a high rise of anti-Semitism around her, unlike anything she experienced before.
Rezin Bet-Or calls it a really painful irony that Milgram died in the kind of anti-Semitic attack that she was struggling to combat.
Odette, turning to you, you went to the Chicago neighborhood this morning where the suspect is believed to live. What did you see?
Yeah, Ari, this is, you know, a leafy, quiet residential side street in a neighborhood on the northwest side of Chicago. It's a very diverse area with lots of Mexican, Middle Eastern, and Asian establishments nearby. This is an area of the city with lots of families with kids, you know, near the Chicago train stop. The building is a red brick multi-unit building. When I got there, I actually walked right up to the entryway, and here's a sense of what I was seeing. And you can hear in this the helicopters that were buzzing overhead. I'm at the address listed as the subject's. In the windows of the first floor apartment, there are political signs. There's also a sign in one of the windows to the right with a picture of a small boy, and under it, it says, "Justice for Wadia." Wadia, that's referring to Wadia Al-Fayoumi, a six-year-old Palestinian-American child in South Suburban Chicago. You'll recall, Ari, he was stabbed to death by his landlord in a hate crime a week after the October 7th attack by Hamas on Israel. There were other posters in the window, one for the local council member who's with the Democratic Socialists of America, another one saying ceasefire now, and some other leftist messaging. And basically, as soon as I snapped a picture, an FBI agent rushed me away because then half a dozen black Suburbans suddenly came down the block, stopped, and agents in full tactical gear got out and went into the unit.
Did you learn anything about the suspect himself?
Most of what we know so far has come from court documents. They say that he purchased the 9mm gun in Illinois 5 years ago and had it in his checked luggage when he flew from Chicago to D.C. the day before the attack. In an interview with police, he expressed admiration for an individual who had set himself on fire in protest of the war and called that individual, quote, a martyr. The FBI says they're examining some online writings that may be connected to the suspect. I've looked through some of those. There are posts that embrace political violence, one of them suggesting to bomb a journalism outlet, another one saying death to Israel, and reposts of videos featuring the former leader of the militant anti-Israel group Hezbollah. But again, we haven't confirmed that these are his accounts. He has no criminal record prior to this that we could find, so still lots of questions.
Reporting there from NPR's Odette Youssef and Jennifer Ludden, thank you both.
Thank you.
To other news today, the Senate has just voted to revoke California's right to require companies to sell more electric vehicles. Now, California has a unique ability to set air pollution rules that are stricter than the national standards. And the way that lawmakers voted today is controversial. It went against the advice of their own parliamentarian. NPR's Camilla Domonoske joins me to talk about this development, this major development in the EV policy battle. Hey there.
Hi, Mary.
Tell me a little bit more about what current California EV policy is.
Yeah, the policy that's really at the heart of this debate here requires carmakers to sell more zero-emission vehicles. More than a third of new sales starting in the next model year, all the way up to 100% of new cars being zero-emission EVs, basically, by 2035. California is the only state that can set its own rules like this, and that's because they've been regulating air pollution for so long, but other states can choose to follow California. And it's also important that every time California makes a rule like this, which they've done many times, they need permission from the Environmental Protection Agency, a waiver. This particular waiver was granted under the Biden administration, and now Congress has voted to reverse it.
Walk us through the stakeholders here. Who stands to lose? Who stands to gain?
Well, the oil industry and traditional automakers are big winners here. Both of those industries have called California's mandate unfair and unfeasible and lobbied very hard against it. This is also a win for anyone who says that these kinds of rules deprive consumers of choices by shaping what cars companies are able to sell. On the other side, California is a global leader in the push to fight climate change. And environmental groups say that dismantling the EV requirement undermines that, which affects everybody. And then public health groups say emission standards save human lives through cleaner air, which is a local impact that's big in California. Revoking these EPA waivers would be a blow to those health goals.
Okay, so sounds like there's a debate over that Congress did this at all. There's also a debate over how they did this. Explain.
Yeah, Congress used a law called the Congressional Review Act, or the CRA, which allows lawmakers to undo rules from agencies with a simple majority vote. No filibustering is allowed. And the question is an EPA waiver a rule? The parliamentarian, Congress's in-house rules interpreter for the Senate, said, no, it's not a rule, so the CRA doesn't apply. Her guidance is non-binding, but it's extremely rare to disregard it. And in this case, the Senate did. Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer said that this busts norms and that expands the use of the CRA in a way that gives more power to the majority, which he said Republicans might regret the next time Democrats are in power.
Republicans should tread very carefully today. What goes around comes around.
Now, Republicans say that Congress is acting within its rights here, and Senate Majority Leader John Thune said he doesn't buy that Democrats are really upset about procedures.
I think they're somewhat frantic at the prospect of losing this Green New Deal policy.
So, Camilla, what comes next?
Well, President Trump is expected to sign this. This is a major priority for him. California officials have said they will challenge it in court, which will be interesting because the CRA says that it is not subject to judicial review.
And PR's Camilla Domonoske, thank you.
Thank you.
Memorial Day weekend kicks off a busy few months for the country's national parks. Visitors descend on national treasures stretching from Acadia National Park in Maine all the way to Volcanoes National Park in Hawaii and lots of others in between.
People go during the summer. Any other time, these parks are more or less empty.
That is Graham Avril. He covers the national parks for Outside Magazine. He says this year it is not just the weather that's changing, park staffing levels are too.
People need to be prepared to not have the front country help that they're used to having.
That's because there are fewer people working for the National Park Service today than at the start of the Trump administration.
The National Parks Conservancy Association estimates that the Park Service has lost 13% of its workforce since January through deferred resignations, buyouts, and early retirements. That's about 2,500 fewer employees. Avril says he's already seen the effects.
So I went to the Smokies recently for a hike. It's an area that I've been to many times, has a little ranger station, has a bathroom, and a handful of trails that branch off from a campground. The campground was closed. It's not going to open this summer. The bathrooms were closed. They're not going to open this summer. The trails are still open, but there wasn't a ranger for me to talk to. There wasn't a bathroom for me to visit before my hike.
Avril says no park will be totally closed this summer, and people should still plan to go. They'll just need to adjust their expectations.
Maybe the visitor center isn't open for as many hours, or maybe there's a longer line at the entrance station, right?
He also warns that food concession stands may be shut down, so visitors should plan to bring their own food and take their own trash out of the park.
And yes, it could be hard to get a camping site inside a national park this year, but Avril says you still have options.
Most of our national parks are surrounded by either national forest land or Bureau of Land Management property. And so while you may not be able to find a campsite inside the national park, there's a good chance you can find one just outside the national park in a very similar landscape.
So plan ahead. And if you do visit a national park this summer, Avril has this advice.
Kind of remember to be nice. The staff that you do see are going to be working their tails off. Be nice to them. Tell them thanks for being there.
Some helpful tips there from Graham Avril. He covers the national parks for Outside Magazine.
Listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from the Wallace Foundation, an independent nonpartisan research foundation collaborating with grantees and partners in the arts, school leadership, and youth development. More at wallacefoundation.org. From Jarl and Pamela Mohn, focusing on civil liberties, foster youth, public radio, and the arts. And from the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, at wtgrantfdn.org.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. In the span of one recent week, federal prosecutors charged four non-U.S. citizens with illegal voting. President Trump, Elon Musk, and other Republicans have been fixated on the idea of non-citizens voting in large numbers in U.S. elections. NPR's Miles Parks and Jude Joffe Block have been looking into these cases and what the charges mean for the ongoing debate around voting restrictions. Hey there.
Hey, Ari.
Hello.
Miles, to start with you, who got arrested, and do these cases bolster the argument Republicans are making about voter fraud?
They do not seem to. I mean, for over a year, Trump and Musk have insisted that the Biden administration was letting migrants without legal status into the United States to vote for Democrats. There's never been evidence of that, and there's never been evidence that non-citizens vote in American elections at anything but microscopic numbers. One of the cases, the man has been here for more than a decade, and he actually seems to be a big Trump supporter. In other court documents, he's on the record as saying, calling Trump the greatest man of our times. In another, a mother and a daughter were in the U.S. legally. They were green card holders, but they told a federal investigator they didn't realize that meant they couldn't also vote. And I should also note they have both pleaded not guilty.
Does intent and knowledge matter for illegal voting?
The statute does not specify that you have to know voting was illegal. And sure, there are some isolated cases of intentional voter fraud, but I talked with Professor Benji Cover, who's at the University of Idaho, and his work has found that a lot of non-citizen cases are actually voter mistakes and not fraud. And he says when you conflate the two things, the policy solutions for responding to them are really different.
When you start with this very heated political rhetoric and this false premise that there's this just massive widespread voter fraud, that suggests a very different set of solutions that involves making it much, much harder for everybody to register and much, much harder for everybody to vote.
Cover told me he's worried that these isolated few arrests are going to be used to justify new voting restrictions.
Well, let me ask about that. There has been a huge push for stricter voting rules over the last few years. Jude, is there any evidence that these recent arrests are moving the needle even more?
Well, yeah, it's worth noting that the timing of these four arrests is coming right in the middle of a national policy debate about whether Americans should have to show proof of citizenship to register to vote, like a passport or a birth certificate. Republicans in Congress are pushing the SAVE Act, which would require that. The bill passed the House. It's before the Senate now. President Trump is also seeking to enact these restrictions by executive order. And almost half of all states considered legislation this session to add proof of citizenship requirements for voter registration, and a few recently passed laws.
In these cases, authorities also credited DOGE, the Department of Government Efficiency, with helping in some of the arrests. What role did Elon Musk's team play here?
Right. The Secretary of Homeland Security and Justice Department both credited DOGE in some of these arrests, but neither agency gave us more details about what that meant. But people affiliated with DOGE have publicly said that they're comparing Social Security data to state voter rolls to try to find potential non-citizens who voted. And they told reporters recently they've referred dozens of these cases to federal law enforcement, but we've only seen this handful so far. We did hear from White House spokesperson Liz Houston, who told us anyone who says non-citizen voting isn't a problem is, quote, delusional and lying. The White House also pointed to a few dozen other cases of non-citizens voting going back to 2011.
But a few dozen cases over more than a decade compared to the hundreds of millions of votes cast in recent elections would seem to be a tiny fraction.
Yeah, I mean, we know Trump and many on the right use these sort of anecdotes to drive the idea that more requirements are necessary for everyone, even though research has shown these sort of requirements could make voting significantly harder for as many as 1 in 10 eligible Americans.
And what's interesting, we talked with Michigan Secretary of State Jocelyn Benson about this. She's a Democrat, and she recently audited her state's election in 2024 and found that fewer than 20 non-citizens voted out of the more than 5 million votes that were cast. She referred those cases to law enforcement and said she's supportive of the government doing more on the back end to try to get non-citizens off of the voter rolls, but she doesn't want those burdens passed on to voters on the front end. Benson said she wants the government to use a scalpel to address this problem, not a sledgehammer.
That's NPR's Miles Parks and Jude Jaffe Block. Thank you both.
Thanks, Ari.
Thank you.
House Republicans approved the reconciliation bill, which includes unprecedented cuts to the largest feeding program in the nation. The Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, SNAP, stands to lose nearly $300 billion if the bill passes the Senate. Texas Public Radio's Paul Flav talked to people who will be most affected by the potential cuts.
Looking out from under his ball cap with the words Marines stitched across the bill, Richard Maldonado's eyes are tired. He got to this parking lot on San Antonio's southwest side at 4 a.m. for a food bank distribution. It doesn't start until 9, but he says he didn't want to miss out.
Without them, we'd be in bad shape.
Sitting next to him, Karina Gutierrez says her SNAP dollars, which she still calls food stamps, are running out more quickly, and they have to rely even more on the San Antonio Food Bank.
We get the stamps once a month, and before we know it, by almost 2 weeks, we're out of food.
The couple are in their 60s and 70s. Maldonado worries there will be less food to go around if the government cuts SNAP, and they will have to turn to family for help.
We're going to be dependent on people like donating money or food or whatever. Yeah. It's going to come down to that.
Up ahead, teams of volunteers cut open 50-pound bags of white onions. Next to them, volunteers rush to break down pallets of limes, canned green beans, broccoli, and yellow squash.
Squash going into this bag, so you're just going to keep on filling up squash.
More than 250 cars are already in line for food, and more keep showing up.
As the administration moves towards budget reconciliation, we have less food in our warehouse to serve lines like this.
San Antonio Food Bank CEO Eric Cooper says his organization has lost $8 million in federal funding in Trump's first 100 days. SNAP helped more than 41 million people afford food in an average month in 2024. According to the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities, a nonpartisan research institute. If the spending bill ends up passing in the Senate, the center warns that expanded work requirements would strip food assistance from millions of Americans, and food banks would have to step in to bridge the gap.
The trickle-down will be rationing. I'll take the food that we have here at the distribution, cut it in half, and then basically give families less.
The reconciliation bill requires the states to pay a portion of the food benefit costs for the first time. And Northwestern University economist Diane Schanzenbach says if the U.S. sinks into a recession, states with shrinking revenues and must balance budgets won't be able to afford it.
We'd be setting up a situation where just when people are most needing SNAP benefits, they're hardest to get.
Back at the food distribution, the line is moments away from moving. Jesse Monsevais says every little bit helps for people like him.
And you go to the store, you get two bags, that's already like $50. You ain't got nothing in them. I think these lines are going to get longer if they cut everything.
Lines of cars filled with hungry people that may end up getting less food. For NPR News, I'm Paul Flav in San Antonio.
This is NPR News.
In Minneapolis, the intersection where a police officer killed George Floyd 5 years ago is now adorned with flowers and inscribed with the names of other victims of police violence.
This space has grown and evolved to be a space that has been a space of sanctity and protest for people of all different backgrounds.
Reflections from George Floyd Square, tomorrow on Morning Edition from NPR News.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Ari Shapiro.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. When it comes to President Trump's embrace of cryptocurrency, the White House says nothing to see here.
I think everybody, the American public, believe it's absurd for anyone to insinuate that this president is profiting off of the presidency.
What to know about tonight's Trump coin dinner after the news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Janine Herbst. The Trump administration released a sweeping report today on what's driving chronic disease among the country's children. Much of the report reflects priorities of Secretary of Health Robert F. Kennedy Jr. that he's discussed as part of his Make America Healthy Again platform. NPR's Will Stone has more.
The report catalogs the uptick in obesity, asthma, autoimmune conditions, and behavioral health disorders among kids. The 72-page document is a product of the MAHA Commission, which was established by President Trump, and includes Kennedy and other members of Trump's cabinet. It identifies four major drivers for childhood chronic illness: poor diet, environmental chemicals, chronic stress and lack of physical activity, and over-medicalization. Public health experts say the report correctly identifies some of the causes, but also fails to acknowledge the importance of social factors like poverty, and that it doesn't offer a clear vision for how this monumental challenge will be addressed, even as the administration cuts back on funding for research and public health. Will Stone, NPR News.
At least two people are dead after a small private plane crashed into a military neighborhood in San Diego, California, early this morning. Katie Anastas from member station KPBS has more.
One home was badly damaged and several cars burned. Scott Wall is San Diego's police chief.
With the jet fuel going down the street and everything on fire all at once, it was pretty horrific to see.
The Federal Aviation Administration says six people were on board the plane. Music agency Sound Talent Group told the Associated Press that included three of its employees. At least eight other people were injured while evacuating. The National Transportation Safety Board is investigating the crash. For NPR News, I'm Katie Anastas in San Diego.
U.S. futures contracts are trading flat at this hour. Dow futures are up a fraction. You're listening to NPR News. Gaza's health ministry released its most updated list of Palestinians killed by Israel in the war. Israel says the ministry's figures are unreliable. The list, which runs 1,000 pages long, details the names of the dead, revealing a third are children. NPR's Aya Batraoui has more.
Gaza's health ministry says a third of the more than 53,000 people killed by Israel in the war are children. The overall death toll in Gaza does not identify how many combatants are among the dead. Yet in its latest published list of names, ages, and national ID numbers of Palestinians killed, the health ministry identifies 16,500 of them as children who are 17 years old or younger. More than 900 are babies under a year old. UNICEF says children in Gaza face relentless bombardment and are also starving from a lack of food. Israel this week expanded its military offensive in Gaza against Hamas. Under mounting international pressure, it allowed in for the first time in nearly 3 months a limited number of trucks carrying flour and nutritional supplements for children. Aya Batraoui, NPR News, Dubai.
The Senate voted to block California's first-in-the-country rule banning the sale of new gas-powered cars by 2035. Lawmakers today passed two resolutions rolling back the state's vehicle emission standards, and the Senate also passed a measure overturning rules on smog-forming nitrogen oxide pollution from trucks. I'm Janine Herbst, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from the Council for Interior Design Qualification, whose certified designers work to protect occupants through the design of code-compliant and accessible environments. Learn more at cidq.org/NPR. From Indeed, committed to giving job listings increased visibility with relevant candidates through its sponsored jobs feature. Learn more at indeed.com/NPR. And from listeners like you, who donate to this NPR station.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Ari Shapiro.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. Tonight, President Trump is expected to be the special guest at a dinner at one of his golf clubs for the top 220 holders of a cryptocurrency that bears his name. The Trump Coin Dinner highlights Trump's recent embrace of crypto. It also highlights conflict of interest concerns about the president profiting from the industry. NPR's Stephen Fowler is on this story. He is with us now. Hey there.
Hey there.
The Trump Coin Dinner. Tell us more.
Well, we know some basics. It's at Trump's golf club near Washington, D.C. It's technically organized by an entity called Fight 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 LLC, affiliated with the Trump Organization, and that the president is the invited special guest. This dinner is marketed for the top holders of Trump's meme coin, which was launched just before his inauguration in January. And this meme coin, Mary Louise, think of it as a digital asset more than an investment. So the tokens are only worth what people are willing to pay for it.
And who are these people who are willing to pay for it, willing to buy these tokens for a chance at dinner with the president?
Well, we don't exactly know that much other than what people are willing to share. These crypto wallet holders are anonymous and only known by short nicknames on a leaderboard, names like Sun, Hype, Meow. Some of them have publicly identified themselves. For example, Sun is Justin Sun, a Chinese-born crypto entrepreneur who's invested in Trump's crypto ventures and earlier this year had an investigation by the Securities and Exchange Commission into his company paused. And other reporting finds many of the holders are based in foreign countries and are buying these coins on exchanges that you can't access in the U.S.
Okay, I mentioned conflict of interest concerns. Just speak to that for a minute. What are the ethical implications here?
Well, this is not Trump acting in his official capacity as president. He's not technically the organizer of this event, but you can't ignore the fact that he is the president. Ethics experts have raised concerns about the largely anonymous group of people that could include foreign nationals who otherwise would not be able to directly give money in U.S. politics. The White House has repeatedly pointed out the president's assets are in a blind trust. Just today, Press Secretary Karoline Leavitt said Trump is abiding by conflict of interest laws.
And I think everybody, the American public, believe it's absurd for anyone to insinuate that this president is profiting off of the presidency.
That said, the setup of Trump's coin and his crypto business does mean those entities get a cut every time somebody buys and sells the coin. Crypto data firm Chainalysis says that's been hundreds of millions of dollars so far.
Well, and just back up for a second, because I'm remembering a day not that long ago when Donald Trump called crypto a scam. He was not a fan. Why the change in tune?
Well, a Pew survey from last October sheds light. Nearly 1 in 5 U.S. adults invest in crypto. Similar shares of Democratic and Republican-leaning voters do so. They're predominantly younger and male, and that makes them smack dab in the prime demographic that Trump did significant outreach to during the presidential campaign last year. Since taking office, Trump has signed executive orders dealing with strategic digital reserves and hosted crypto events at the White House to talk about legislation and regulation of the industry.
Speaking of regulation, where is regulation on this? How is all of this impacting legislative efforts?
Well, the industry has poured big money across the aisle to help legitimize crypto's role in the financial space, but Trump's efforts and profits have threatened to derail a bill called the Genius Act that would regulate some cryptocurrencies, though not these meme coins like the one Trump is using. A big criticism from opponents is that the bill doesn't include any conflict of interest language, and they say the president exemplifies the need for including that.
And Pierre Stephen Fowler, thank you.
Thank you.
Everyone has a list of red flags when they're dating, things that could strain a relationship, like diverging political views. NPR's Elena Moore talked to young voters about politics and love.
On a breezy Saturday morning last fall, Penn State student Trevor Keller was walking to send in his ballot. The presidential election was just about a week away, and it was 21-year-old Keller's first time voting.
It feels exciting. Excited to get to put my opinion out there.
By Keller's side is his girlfriend, 19-year-old Rhiannon Costanzo, who goes to another state school and is visiting for the weekend. Neither was excited by the options at the top of the ticket, but in the end, they voted for different candidates. Keller backed then-Vice President Kamala Harris, and Costanzo, she backed President Trump.
I just felt like for this election, he was sort of the better of the two options, which I know a lot of people are saying that it's sort of like the better of two evils or whatever, which he says a lot.
You say that on the other side?
Yeah, you're shoehorned in. Maybe I don't necessarily agree with everything that they're saying, so it's like you just have to pick one.
The two don't talk about politics a lot, but when they do, they say it's respectful and it doesn't weigh on their relationship.
I don't think that you should pick and choose someone either over what party they align with or what their views are. I think it's more important to get to know the individual person and what things in their life have shaped those views.
But these two and their relationship are not like many in their generation. In fact, a majority of those under 45 say it is important to date or marry someone who shares their political views. That's according to the latest NPR PBS News Marist poll. It's something that appears to matter less and less among older generations. 6 in 10 of 18 to 29-year-olds feel that way, compared to just a third of those over 60. Daniel Cox is a senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute and has studied the connection between politics and dating.
People in previous generations, they report that they didn't even know the politics of the person they were dating for a good long time because it just wasn't as relevant as other information. You know, do you belong to the same church? What kind of work do you do?
Cox says there's been an evolution in how people see politics.
One reason that politics has, I think, become more salient is for, I think, a lot of people, it becomes an easy shorthand for character or values.
31-year-old Abby Smith in Texas feels that way. She's a conservative Republican who took part in NPR's survey and says that she shares the same beliefs as her husband.
There used to be like political issues and then life issues, but now so many cultural issues are part of politics as well, that essentially if you had different politics, you would have a completely different worldview.
She acknowledges that it may depend on how passionate folks are about politics and be less of a deal breaker for moderates. NPR's poll backs that up. Though a majority of Democrats and Republicans say having a partner with the same politics matters, 60% of independents don't think they need the same politics to have a good partnership. That's how Costanzo and Keller feel. Months into Trump's term, we all caught up.
I think if we added like stigma around talking about politics, I feel like that'd kind of become honestly worse.
I think it's nice to kind of throw back and forth our ideas and kind of talk about it. And I think we learn more about each other too.
To them, other things take priority. Here's how they describe their favorite qualities about each other.
He is very kind and very wonderful in a lot of other ways, but I do very, very much love his humor.
Thank you. I have nothing to say. No, I'm just kidding.
Okay.
Probably the most kind and caring person I've ever met. She's just always there for me.
Even when she jokes with him that her candidate won in the end. Elena Moore, NPR News.
Listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. A large proposed Muslim housing development in North Texas is facing unprecedented scrutiny from top state officials. They are calling for investigations, including a Department of Justice probe. Caroline Love from member station KERA in Dallas has more.
Many members of the East Plano Islamic Center, also known as EPIC, live a short walk away so they can answer the call to prayer. They shop at nearby grocery stores that sell halal meat and drink coffee at a cafe that serves pistachio lattes and saffron milk cakes. Islamic scholar Yasser Qadi says this growing community needs more space.
So the idea came, well then, why not build a purpose-built community?
That community is Epic City. The proposed housing development would be about 40 miles northeast of Dallas. It would have a new mosque, more than 1,000 single and multifamily homes, a faith-based school, commercial developments, and more. Epic City hasn't been built yet, but Texas Governor Greg Abbott and State Attorney General Ken Paxton have already started several investigations into the project. Abbott and Paxton claim the project violates the state's fair housing and consumer protection laws. And Texas Senator John Cornyn says the Department of Justice launched a federal probe early May after he shared concerns about religious discrimination. At a recent public meeting, local resident Krista Shields said the concern is that people living in this unbuilt community would enforce strict Sharia law, although she didn't offer any proof.
They will do Sharia, the most Sharia compliance, including honor killings, stonings, marrying their young girls off to older men.
Mustafa Carroll from the Dallas-Fort Worth office of the Council of American Islamic Relations says that Sharia law is often misunderstood. Muslim scholars emphasize that Sharia law is deeply dependent on context. While conservative countries may enforce strict practices, Muslims in Western countries often don't. According to Epic, Sharia encompasses aspects of Islamic traditions like when to pray, how to dress, and what to eat. Carroll says it's not the stereotypes people typically ascribe to it.
Your daughters are going to wear burqas, your sons will be terrorists, and they're going to be killing people, and people will be blowing folks up and all this kind of craziness.
Carroll says people can follow both Sharia law and the U.S. Constitution. He says Abbott and Paxton are spreading hateful misinformation and stereotypes about Islam. In response to NPR's request for comment, Abbott's office says the Council of American Islamic Relations sympathizes with anti-Semitic hate groups. Paxton's office didn't respond to a request for comment. Epic's attorney Dan Cogdell says the proposed community is open to anyone, and residents would not be required to adhere to Sharia law and would be free to practice, or not practice, any religion. Last month, the governor ordered Epic City to cease all construction or face legal consequences, but they haven't even broken ground. Cogdell says that order, along with the state's investigations, was premature.
We haven't even filed for an application. It's like, good God, have a cup of coffee before you pop off.
Cogdell says the plan for the proposed community is still in the early stages and won't start construction for years. In the meantime, he says Epic will cooperate fully with all investigations, and he expects the political scrutiny could delay the project, but Epic's members still hope they can build a larger space for their growing community. For NPR News, I'm Caroline Love in Plano.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. In a letter today to Harvard University, the Trump administration revoked the school's ability to enroll international students. It's part of a weeks-long battle that began when Harvard refused to follow demands from the administration to overhaul its campus policies. The administration has already frozen billions of dollars in federal funding for the university, and without international students, Harvard stands to lose another crucial source of revenue. NPR's Janaki Mehta is following the story. Hi, Janaki.
Hi, Ari.
What did the administration tell Harvard in this letter?
So in the letter, the Department of Homeland Security says that Harvard's Student in Exchange Visitor Program certification has been revoked. In a statement, DHS said, quote, Harvard can no longer enroll foreign students and existing foreign students must transfer or lose their legal status. It goes on to say that Harvard's leadership has made their campus an unsafe environment by, quote, permitting anti-American pro-terrorist agitators to harass and physically assault individuals, including many Jewish students. And DHS claims many of those so-called agitators are foreign students, and Secretary Christine Noem said it's not a privilege. It's a privilege, not a right, for universities to enroll them and benefit from their tuition payments.
How has Harvard responded?
Yeah, so a spokesperson got back to us with comment saying they consider the government's actions unlawful. They also said, quote, we're fully committed to maintaining Harvard's ability to host our international students and scholars who hail from more than 140 countries and enrich the university and this nation immeasurably.
How many international students does Harvard have, and how is this likely to impact the school's bottom line?
Yeah, so more than a quarter of the students who went to Harvard this school year were international students. That's nearly 6,800 students. It's a number that's grown steadily over the last two decades, according to Harvard's enrollment data. Tuition alone at Harvard is close to $60,000, so many of these students are paying a lot to be there. And Ari, if we zoom out from Harvard for a second, over a million international students attended higher ed institutions in the U.S. in the last school year, and according to federal data, those students contributed more than $50 billion to the U.S. economy in 2023. And one more thing I'll note, international students generally aren't eligible for federal financial aid the same way domestic students are, so they often pay out of their own pockets to go to college in the U.S.
What's likely to happen next?
Well, the letter from DHS lays out a list of demands which Harvard has to meet in the next 72 hours if it wants to regain its ability to enroll international students. Those demands include turning over disciplinary records of those students, video and audio of international students participating in protests, any records of illegal, dangerous, or violent activity involving them. So we'll see if Harvard complies with that request in the next few days.
But this is effective immediately, right? So what does it mean for students right now at Harvard who are from other countries?
Yeah, well, the letter from DHS indicates this order is effective immediately, and according to U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement, when a university certification to admit international students is revoked, students can either try to transfer to another university, change their status, or leave the U.S. But with graduation just a week away, it's unclear what options international students at Harvard might have right now. We'll just have to wait and see if Harvard takes legal action that'll allow them to graduate. Harvard already does have a lawsuit against the Trump administration for freezing billions of dollars in federal funding that's set to go to trial in July.
That is NPR's Janaki Mehta, who covers education for us. Thank you.
Thank you, Ari.
Speaking of the courts, today the Supreme Court, by a 6-3 vote, gave President Trump the power to fire key federal agency members. This is contrary to a 90-year Supreme Court precedent. NPR's Nina Totenberg is here in the studio to explain. Hey, Nina.
Hi there.
How big a deal is this?
Big. The decision is technically a temporary one, but its tone is pretty final, and it's exactly in the direction the conservative court has been going in recent years. What's more, it all but outright reverses the unanimous decision of the court 90 years ago, holding that a president, then it was FDR, cannot fire agency leaders just because they disagree with those agency leaders' views, and because these are agencies created by Congress to be bipartisan and independent. Now comes this order that clearly forecasts the eventual outcome of the case, when and if it is argued before the court, likely next year.
You just described the tone of this as pretty final. Give me an example. What does that mean?
Well, for example, the Federal Reserve is carved out. The idea that the president could fire members of the Federal Reserve, just like he fires other can fire other agency heads, according to this point of view, has completely spooked the markets, and it's what's always been the fly in the ointment of those who want to corral federal agencies and make all commissions like the SEC and the FTC subject to firing at will by the president. So here we are in a two-page order with the court basically insulating the Federal Reserve, saying they're different.
Yeah. The justices who are not on board with this, the dissenters, what are they saying?
Well, those would be the three liberal justices, and they were pretty mad. Justice Kagan, speaking for them, quoted Alexander Hamilton as saying, "To avoid an arbitrary discretion in the courts, it is indispensable that they should be bound down by strict rules and precedents. Today's order," she said, "favors the president over our precedent." And she added, "It does this unrestrained by the rules of briefing and argument and the passage of time needed to discipline our decision-making. I would deny the president's application," she said. "I would do so based on the will of Congress, this court's seminal decision approving independent agencies for cause protections, and the ensuing 90 years of precedent."
Okay, in a separate court order today, busy day for the court, they were deadlocked. This was a big religion case. Tell me about that.
Well, by a tie vote, the court effectively blocked the creation of the nation's first religious charter school in Oklahoma, leaving in place a state Supreme Court ruling that barred the establishment of overtly religious charter schools funded by the taxpayers.
And a tie vote, so 4-4, Nina. I mean, it wasn't actually a decision.
That's correct. A tie vote means only that the lower court decision, here the state Supreme Court ruling, remains in place. And that decision said that establishing religious public charter schools would violate both the state and federal constitutions, as well as the federal law that helped create public charter schools.
Out of curiosity, which of the nine justices did not participate?
Justice Amy Coney Barrett recused herself for undisclosed reasons.
And the other eight who did vote, do we know how they voted?
No, we don't, but I think it's reasonable, based on the oral arguments just a few weeks ago, to conclude that Chief Justice Roberts was the fourth vote against religious charter schools, along with the three liberals, and that the remaining conservatives, Justices Thomas, Alito, Gorsuch, and Kavanaugh, voted the other way to allow religious public charter schools.
And Pierre's Nina Totenberg wrapping up a lot of things happening at the Supreme Court today. Nina, thank you.
Thank you.
And thank you for listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Proven Winners, with Proven Winners Color Choice Shrubs, offering flowering shrubs and evergreens for gardens and landscapes at garden centers nationwide. ProvenWinnersColorChoice.com/NPR. From Your Part-Time Controller, the nonprofit accounting specialists, providing financial management services to support stronger nonprofits who make the world a better place. Learn more at yptc.com/NPR. From Charles Schwab, offering investors choices like full-service wealth management, advice, investing, and trading on thinkorswim. Learn more at schwab.com. And from
Fiber Plus Internet is now available in Sandpoint and King Cove. GCI offers high-speed internet in your community at the same plans and pricing as in Anchorage. More information is available at gci.com/internet.
Yes, baby, I'm going away. Yes, you know I've got to go away. Yes, but am I hungry? Sure. Yes. Listen, I take some lion's potatoes and a pork chop. Don't forget the cornbread or two. Yes. Bye-bye, baby. Will you save your love for me? Sweetie pie, now don't you cry. Just say bye-bye. Bye-bye, baby. Got a little kiss for me. Hug me nice and kiss me twice. And say bye-bye. I'm gonna send a letter telling you where I am, dear.
And then when things get better, I'm gonna send a telegram to you. Bye-bye.